I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash, and we're Building Bridges. Can we stop SCOTUS dragging workers' rights back centuries? The right to strike under attack.
We're about to talk about Say It Ain't So. Limiting the right to strike? I mean, the Supreme Court has already demonstrated that it is out to protect corporations and disempower workers. Now, an impending ruling could actually obliterate workers' right to strike?
Marjorie Cohn, Professor Emerita, Thomas Jefferson School of Law, former president of the National Lawyers League and legal scholar and political analyst, joins us to discuss Glacier Northwest Incorporated versus International Brotherhood of Teamsters Local 174.
Well, striking. As the essential tool for workers to protect themselves, to avoid being at the complete mercy of employers, to give more of a balance between worker and employer power. Without it, more and more governments will ban industrial action and punish people who dare to strike. Well, Marjorie Cohn, thank you for being with us. Thank you for all the work you do. You are one of the par excellent, preeminent human rights lecturers, specialists. You talk the talk and you walk the walk around the world. So tell us how the Supreme Court has a case that, as Ken said, Glacier Northwest Inc. versus International Brotherhood of Teamsters Local Union 174 that what could take away what was written in blood, sweat, and tears, workers' right to strike? And thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Mimi, and for your kind words. This case involves a 2017 strike that the Teamster Local in Seattle called against Glacier Northwest, a ready-mix concrete company. 85 truck drivers walked off the job. 16 of them had trucks that had already been loaded with cement, but they hadn't made their deliveries, and so they returned the trucks to the employers, leaving the trucks running to prevent the concrete from hardening. But Glacier was unable to deliver all the concrete and had to dispose of it. So Glacier sued the union in state court, basically an end run around the National Labor Relations Board. They sued the union in state court for tortious destruction of property, seeking damages for the undelivered cement. But their lawsuit was dismissed by the Washington Supreme Court, which ruled that the National Labor Relations Act preempt state court lawsuits. Then the National Labor Relations Board's general counsel issued a complaint against Glacier, alleging that Glacier had committed unfair labor practices by filing this tort action in state court to retaliate against union members for their strike. The National Labor Relations Board ruled that it was the company that committed the unfair labor practice by retaliating, and that still has to go before the full board, but it has been declared a legal strike by the National Labor Relations Board. Now, the reason that unions do not want employers to be able to go directly to state court without going through the National Labor Relations Board first is that the companies and the corporations can look for a friendly state court, and then their big deep pocket lawyers can run down the union's coffers, forcing the union to spend a lot of money to defend these lawsuits.
How does this particular case wind up with a kind of potential precedent that would actually limit the right to strike? What is the relief that this company is seeking that could result in that kind of a determination by the Supreme Court?
The company wants, the Washington Supreme Court dismissed the lawsuit, saying that they had to go through the National Labor Relations Board first. And so the company appealed that all the way to the Supreme Court. What the company wants is for the Supreme Court to reinstate its tort lawsuit in the Washington Supreme Court, where it is asking for damages against the Teamsters Union. So that's what the Supreme Court has to decide, whether or not to allow corporations to go directly to state court where they can run up big legal fees for the union, or whether they need to go through the federal agency that Congress created, the National Labor Relations Board, which is the premier labor organization that deals with these issues and has a whole body of case law and precedent about what constitutes a lawful strike, what constitutes an unfair labor practice, et cetera.
So why isn't this then limited? When we say tort, just in case somebody might not grab onto that immediately, it means really who bears responsibility for injurious conduct. So how does this wind up to become a political principle that could affect, I'm with the UAW. And frankly, I've wanted my local to have a job action. I wanted them to strike over the fact that legal aid lawyers, for example, we have too big a caseload. So we go out on strike. How could this possibly affect me and my union? Should we decide to do a job action? Should we decide to strike? Just as the nurses did recently in New York. And thanks to public support, wound up getting some respite from the enormity of their workload so that they could better treat their terribly ill patients.
If your union goes on strike, and of course every strike results in economic harm to the employer, that's routine, then the question is whether the money that the company lost, the corporation lost, could be recouped by the company in state court, in New York state court, or whether they first have to get a ruling from the National Labor Relations Board that the union did not engage in protected activity under the National Labor Relations Act first before they can go to state court. So it's really a question of a precedent from 1959, the Garman case, which said that an employer has to obtain a ruling from the National Labor Relations Board saying that the worker's strike was not federally protected before the company can file a lawsuit against the union in state court. And if the National Labor Relations Board decides that the union's action is arguably protected by the National Labor Relations Act, then the state court doesn't have jurisdiction at all to hear the case. That's called Garman preemption. The Teamsters in this case say that Glacier's lawsuit can only be heard in state court if the National Labor Relations Board determines that the union's actions were not protected activity under the National Labor Relations Act, and it would not be protected union activity if the strikers failed to take reasonable precautions to avoid aggravated, imminent, and foreseeable harm to Glacier's property. But the Teamsters argue they did take reasonable precautions to protect the concrete because they told those truck drivers that had trucks already loaded with the concrete to keep the trucks running and to save the concrete. I mean, they could have just brought the trucks back to the employer, turned the trucks off, and the concrete would harden, but they didn't do that. So the Supreme Court has to decide whether to side with the company or the union. Interestingly, the Biden administration filed an amicus brief in support of neither party and participated in oral argument before the Supreme Court. Now, the Biden administration claims to be pro-labor, but Biden signed a bill to block the railway workers' strike. So the Assistant Solicitor General argued for the Biden administration in front of the Supreme Court that the Washington Supreme Court should not have dismissed Glacier's state court case. But he said that once the National Labor Relations Board makes factual findings, then the state court should adopt them. And basically, he argued that the case should be sent back to the state court to consider the National Labor Relations Board's findings. So what the Biden administration is trying to do is to cut it both ways, to split the baby, if you will. Now, during the oral argument, the three liberals Ketanji Brown Jackson, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan all appeared sympathetic to the union's argument that the National Labor Relations Board should hear the case first. And Kagan and Jackson both said the National Labor Relations Board has handled thousands of these cases. They know how to handle these cases. John Roberts said there certainly is a distinction between economic harm to the employer, which is at the heart of many strikes anyway, and intentional destruction of property, the difference between the milk spoiling and killing the cow. That sounds very reasonable, but it's unclear how Roberts would apply this test to the facts of this case. Amy Coney Barrett was concerned about why it took the National Labor Relations Board General Counsel 4 years to file a complaint against Glacier. The Biden administration's lawyer said the delay was an anomaly because Glacier had filed a separate allegation that the state court had to resolve. Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch asked just a few questions. Samuel Alito and Brett Kavanaugh asked none. But Gorsuch is a champion of the deconstruction of the administrative state, which basically means deregulation. It helps corporations. It says that courts can second guess the determinations of administrative agencies. And he has filed a dissenting opinion and a concurring opinion in prior cases saying that the court should get rid of the well-established doctrine of Chevron deference. That Chevron deference means that when a law is ambiguous, courts must defer to the agency's reasonable construction of the statute. But Gorsuch would substitute his own interpretation for that of an agency. And just to give you a few examples of when courts have deferred to agency interpretations of essential protections, courts have deferred to the National Labor Relations Board's reasonable determination that live hall workers are employees entitled to protection of the National Labor Relations Act. Courts have deferred to the Environmental Protection Agency's rule requiring states to reduce emissions from power plants that travel across state lines and harm downwind states. The courts have deferred to the Department of Labor's interpretation of portions of the Black Lung Benefits Act that makes it easier for coal miners afflicted with black lung disease to receive compensation. And courts have deferred to the EPA's revision of regulations under the Toxic Substances Control Act that give more protection from exposure to lead paint. So if Gorsuch has his way, they could even use this case to reverse this Chevron deference and basically cut the legs out from under these administrative agencies that Congress has created to protect our safety and health. So that's another thing that is at stake, in addition to the right to strike. And the problem is that if this Supreme Court, this right-wing Supreme Court, even more right-wing than ever, goes against the union here, it will discourage unions from going on strike, because if they know that they're going to have to defend costly lawsuits in state court, they might not be so willing to go on strike. There have been two cases in the last few years where the Supreme Court has gone against labor. One case, I believe it was from 2018, the Supreme Court, and this is a right-wing Supreme Court, but it's even more right-wing now, of course. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4, the conservatives in the majority, that employees who were not union members didn't have to pay union dues, even though those dues would go to help them with collective bargaining from which they would benefit. And then in 2021, the, again, 5-4 right-wing majority held that employers in California did not have to give access to union organizers, didn't have to allow them to come onto their property as required by the California Agriculture Relations Act. I used to work for the Agricultural Labor Relations Board, and the access rule was one of the real shining stars of that law, because it said that, yes, of course, workers have the right to collectively bargain, but and organize their workers into unions. But how can they do that? How can they organize and get the workers to sign cards asking for an election if they don't have access to the employer's property. And the right-wing majority of the Supreme Court said, oh, the employer's property rights are sacrosanct. Mm. So if this the Supreme Court now, which I said, is even more right-wing, follows these two cases and votes against the union, then it has severe consequences for the right to strike. It will have a chilling effect on unions' willingness to go out on strike.
You know, as you're speaking, I keep thinking about some of the earliest strikes were in the fields where actually enslaved workers withheld their labor power, even there, fighting for different kinds of conditions and some form of betterment, some kind of health and safety precaution. I mean, these were some of the first strikes. 1619, the Jamestown Polish craftsmen strike. There was Polish glassmakers and producers of pitch and tar and turpentine for shipbuilding refused to continue to work for the British Virginia Company. In 1661, indentured servants, right, they went on strike in New York County, Virginia, because of subpar food rationing. And then there are the great railroad strikes and the wonderful, remarkable strikes of the 1834 Lowell Mill Women's Strike. In the face of a 13-hour workdays and wage cuts, the women who ran Lowell Mill in Massachusetts protested for the reinstatement of their original pay and rallied women from other mills to join them in the fight. The precursor in many ways to the conceptualization of, as David Rovix was saying, when all those minimum wage workers went on strike, a general strike. So how significant is this to, in your opinion, how important politically towards repressing and taking away what has been the major tool, although not nearly as robustly used as it should have been or should be? How politically significant is it in this conservative, ultra-conservative Supreme Court to limit the right to strike and the impact on the working class?
Well, it's extremely significant, Mimi. The number of strikes in the United States rose almost 50% between 2021 and 2022, according to Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. And 71% of the U.S. public supports labor unions, the highest number since 1965. But the radical right-wing Supreme Court may be about to deal a severe blow to the right to strike, which is the most potent weapon that workers have to obtain justice. So what will happen if this goes against the union? Labor could get very cautious. Unions could decide that it's too expensive to have major actions and strikes. They might decide not to file unfair labor practice cases because they might end up in state court and have to pay large legal fees. Or they could react by striking more and mounting campaigns in the community to get the people riled up about this and maybe put some pressure on the administration, on Congress and the White House. Now, Biden, again, as I said, speaks out of both sides of his mouth. He's pro-labor, but of course he signed this bill that stopped the railway workers from striking. The tentative agreement between the rail carriers and the unions that was brokered by Biden last September didn't include any guaranteed sick days, and so a majority of the union rank and file voted against ratifying the deal. Well, Biden called on Congress to override union democracy and urge them to impose the contract anyway. Progressive Democrats actually filed a separate resolution that would have mandated 7 paid sick days without the president's public support. That measure passed in the House of Representatives. That's before, of course, the Republicans took over the majority in the House. But it failed in the Senate. All but 6 Republicans voted against it. And so immediately after that contract was imposed on the railway workers, several railroad unions started urging Biden to issue an executive order guaranteeing sick leave in the railway industry, Bernie Sanders and more than 70 members of Congress signed a letter calling on the president to listen to the railway workers at the unions and act on this paid sick leave. So far, no word from Biden.
Well, it sounds to me as if we should be thinking about general strikes of many unions at the same time with the Supreme Court as a focus. But what else can we do about the Supreme Court? And we don't have the time for this at all, but how susceptible are they to public pressure? And what kinds of things could we do to reform the Supreme Court, which is becoming more and more and more right-wing?
Well, the Supreme Court said that it doesn't pay attention to public opinion, but of course you know it does. It's not just coincidental that the right-wingers continually vote in favor of corporations and against social progress. But in terms of anything directly, I mean, obviously, presidents appoint Supreme Court justices. Now, it is possible to increase the number of, I don't want to say justices because there's nothing just about most of them, but members of the Supreme Court. It's not written in the Constitution that it has to be 9 members. FDR, it was called court packing. He wanted to increase the number from 9 to 13 because the 5-4 right-wing majority on the Supreme Court was striking down the New Deal legislation. But before he was able to actually expand the number of members of the Supreme Court, one of the right-wingers changed his vote and started voting to uphold those measures, those New Deal measures. So many people say that FDR lost the battle but won the war. But I don't know that there's really appetite to do that, because the argument on the other side, of course, is that if, let's say, the number of people on the Supreme Court is increased from 9 to 13 and a Democratic president appoints 4 members of the Supreme Court, then when there's a Republican president, the Republican president can appoint, make the court even larger. You know, Congress could make it even larger, and it's very partisan. I mean, you know, of course, we know, I don't have to tell you how partisan things are now in Congress, almost to a ridiculous extent. So there's also talk about term limits, perhaps 18 years, which gives plenty of time for historical memory, but does not make it a lifetime appointment. That's another way that this could be handled. I don't think either one of the increasing the number of members of the Supreme Court or limiting the number of years they can serve is really realistic. So I think that bottom line is people can't rely on the Supreme Court and have to continue to organize and, you know, work on the local level, on the state level, et cetera, and continue the struggle, which people are doing.
And, of course, it's always been our obligation, responsibility, to move from the restrictions to sit in the back of the bus to wind up driving the bus, as Roger Toussaint said when the New York transportation workers went on strike and marched across the bridge to demonstrate their unity as workers. Hey, it's always been about boots on the ground. I can even go back and remember the 1899 newsboy strike when the Spanish-American War led to an increase in newspaper sales. Some publishers raised the bulk price of 100 newspapers from 50 cents to 60 cents. And as a result, newsboys in Long Island City, New York, began the strike against Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst. So, hey, labor movement, get that darn backbone. There's no reason that the AFL-CIO shouldn't be. Maybe there's plenty of reasons, but we'll discuss that another time. But they should all be out, and every union should be making its thoughts on this. And we want to thank you. And I want to, in the 2 minutes that we have left, just switch gears to make sure that people know about this case and protest it, because public opinion does matter. And give you an opportunity to say something about freedom of press and the release. You hear that, Biden? It's another issue, the release of Julian Assange, because I know you've been enormously involved in that. So let's just go out with punctuating it with something to support freedom of press by the release of Mr. Julian Assange.
Yes, I would direct people to the article of mine that was published today on Truthout called "Prosecution of Assange Would Lead to End of the First Amendment advocates warn. And I cite testimony at the Belmarsh Tribunal that was held on January 20th in Washington, D.C., from Dan Ellsberg, Jeremy Corbyn, Amy Goodman, many, many experts. And when Joe Biden was part of the Obama administration, Obama, who indicted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than all prior presidents combined, refused to indict Julian Assange, a publisher, because of the New York Times problem, because WikiLeaks did exactly what the New York Times did, published classified information that the public has a right to know. So Obama didn't charge him. Trump charged him. Assange is languishing in a maximum security prison in London. He's been there for almost 4 years. He's facing 175 years in prison if he's extradited to the United States. And rather than dismissing Trump's indictment, Biden is going full speed ahead. And so people need to pressure people in Congress, and particularly Biden and Merrick Garland and the Department of Justice, to drop the charges against Julian Assange. What was his crime? Revealing evidence of U.S. war crimes.
Well, Marjorie Cohn, Professor Emerita, Thomas Jefferson School of Law, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and legal scholar and political analyst, thank you for talking to us about and alerting us to the case of, keep this in mind, folks, Glacier Northwest Inc. versus International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Local Union Number 174, which portends a weakening or a threat and a chilling of organized labor's right to strike. And it doesn't have to be organized labor, but any group of workers' right to strike. You all have the right to withhold your labor to push those damn bosses to do what you need them to. You create the wealth. So, Marjorie, thank you for the work you do. Thank you for that final punctuation to free Julian Assange. And we'll have you back many more times because of the great work you do. And look up Marjorie Cohn. Make sure you get her books, read them carefully, and certainly her articles. It's been a pleasure always. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for your great work as well.
Appreciate it. And this is Building Bridges, and we do just that. We build bridges to you, and we educate, agitate, and organize for another world as possible if we have the tools to and work hard to make it so. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Kay Nash.
And we're saying stay strong, stay alert, keep organizing.